Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Well, good evening, everybody. Good evening, and welcome once again to the second in these series of talks about democracy in danger. The basic theme of it is what they're not telling you, and they're not telling us a great deal about what I'm going to talk about now, which is the European Union, what lies behind it, and what it's all about. There you have a picture of the goddess Europa. Europa will be familiar to a lot of people who watch football, and because there's a Europa League. And for most people, that's it. Europa means something to do with the geography, possibly astronomy as well, because one of the moons of, I think, either Jupiter or Saturn is also called Europa. But what people won't necessarily be aware of is, and this is the thing that's important to the European Union, is that Europa is actually a goddess, a moon goddess, a goddess of the night. And there are two specific versions of the legend that surround her. The most popular one is the Greek one, whereby she's the daughter of King Agenor, or Agenor, who gave his name to the Aegean Sea. That's that particular one, but there's a more interesting one where she's the daughter of Canaan. Canaan is a real person who gave his name to the land of Canaan. Now that's the one I'm going to concentrate on, because Canaan is of the bloodline of Noah, and this is important to certain people within the European Union, the royal fraternity, who are into this sort of stuff. Basically, what the legend of Europa is in both accounts of this is that she was a Phoenician princess living in Canaan, and she had she was down by the beach gathering flowers when she saw a bull, either a white bull or a black bull. It varies in the versions of the legend, which fascinated her. So she followed with it and sort of it bent over, and she jumped on its back, and suddenly, because it was by the sea, it tore out to sea, carrying her on its back, and they arrived in Crete, where she gave birth, she mated with the bull, who introduced himself as Zeus, the character of Zeus. So this is part of the fable. But the interesting thing is that a lot of historians say this is actually based, or coming round to say, which is actually based on a real event. There was actually somebody called Europa who lived in Phoenicia at that time. The Noah line is, of course, the bloodline of the fallen angels. It goes right back to the early... I don't know if anybody's read Zachariah Sitchin, I'm sure Andy has. Goes back to this whole, it's highly controversial stuff, but you can be assured that, as I've said, the royalty and the European royalty are aware of this sort of stuff, and they're into it. The whole interesting thing about the bull is, of course, that it represents the masculine side, whereas the goddess is the feminine side, so you have the masculine, feminine aspect of this. Next. Right. This image is very important to the European Union. This one shows her by the European Parliament building in Strasbourg, the French city with a German-sounding name. And that's interesting. That building is interesting in itself, but I'll be talking about that, coming back to that a little later, because it's connected to the symbology of Nimrod. Now, if we look at Europa's origins as a goddess, characteristics go back to Babylon, and they're also depicted in the Egyptian in Isis. And this is basically as the goddess of the 12 stars, crown goddess. In the first picture, I should have alluded to it earlier, you saw the stars of the European flag, the 12 stars of the European flag. Now, most people think that 12 stars of the European flag, which are around in a circle, are to do with the number of countries in the EU. But that flag was adopted by the Council of Europe in the mid-1950s, when there were only six countries in what was then fledgling European Economic Community. So EU flag, a number of cells on it, has got nothing to do with the countries, and it's got everything to do with this type of ancient symbology. Woman riding the beast, that's very important, that image, because it says that she's in charge, the look no hands image. And so the woman is actually dominating the beast, and that's important. Next slide, thank you. This is outside the European Commission building in Brussels, and this is the Commission. If you just to quickly go into the sort of tiered polyphere of the European Union, the Commission, which sits here, is the most powerful body in the European Union tiered system. The commissioners are completely unelected. They're ex-politicians, various people, and they are appointed. And they're appointed. Nobody knows quite how they're appointed, but they are appointed by, by various committees oversee the European Commission. It's very complex and secretive. It's a very complex and secretive process. People like, for instance, Peter Mandelson has been at European Commission for some time. Of course, he's very much linked to the Rothschilds thing, but he's a Rothschild student, so to speak. Again, this image turns up on stamps and also on the coins. That one was issued in 1979 by us, as you can actually see, 20.5p in the top right-hand side. And that wouldn't get you very far today if you wanted to send some communications out. But what is interesting about this whole thing, you can't see the stars around the goddess there, but it's also symbolic. It turns up in the Book of Revelation as the woman of the apocalypse, and this is obviously in the Christian version, but it's the same person, it's the same woman riding the beast. Sometimes she's holding a cup, which is symbolic of the grail, but of course that is the grail of the womb, not again the Christian version, it's more the Gnostic version. But this, again, is important to the European Union. And if I can make a quote here from Leon Marshall, the former Secretary General of the Council of Europe. And when he was questioned about this image, he said, "It's wonderful that we have gotten back to the introit of the new mass of the Assumption. It is the crown of 12 stars of the woman of the apocalypse." So, I mean, that's a European official telling you what it is, basically. And what these people are into. The EU is almost a religion in itself. In fact, it is a religion in itself. These people think they can do no wrong, basically, and that they're sort of right all the time. And it's this sort of sanctimonious. I can't really describe it. It's sort of it's just a religion in itself, and they are sort of supreme sort of carriers out of this religion, and their sort of will is not to be challenged in any way. Next one. Here we have another version of it. One on the left doesn't look too happy. It looks a bit like a goat that's been sawn in half. Very strange. But again, we have the woman with the crown of 12 stars, not the EU countries, but the crown goddess from the ancient Middle East. Yes, oh yes. Hindsight is a wonderful thing, actually. If only we knew what this guy was really up to at the time. I'm going to take you forward to 1970. Some of the young, most people here will recognise who that is. He actually was a former spy. his spying activities continued right up until he died. He was a member of West German intelligence unit, along with Geoffrey Rippon, his sort of arch-conspirator, Roy Jenkins, who was the leader of the or involved in the Social Democratic Party. He founded that as a high-ranking Labour minister in the Wilson Harold Wilson government. But in effect, he'd been working for the European Union since 1958. And what happened was, in 1969, there was something called the Werner Report. Pierre Werner was the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, and he compiled this report, which moved forward the whole ethos of the Union, the European Union, moving towards a federal state of Europe. This was a secret document that went out, that very few people knew about it. Soon as Edward Heath was elected in 1970, a copy of this document was sent to him, saying that we are now ready to move towards a federal state. And he acted straight away. He commandeered three other ministers in his cabinet. And what they did was that they set up inside the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in the autumn of 1970, a special unit, a public disinformation unit, which is made up of civil servants. And they were given a budget of £400,000 in order to do this. That may seem like not a lot of money these days, but it was actually quite a lot of money 45 years ago. And what they did was, these civil servants sent out letters to the press purporting to come from members of the public who didn't exist. Some of them, they may even use the names of dead people to do it, I'm not sure, but the letters that were sent out were absolute pure propaganda to say what a wonderful thing it was to be in the world, to join the European Union, everybody should do it, and that. So that is where he and his colleagues really misled everybody. There were three other ministers involved in this. One was Alec Douglas Hume. I'm sure some people here will remember. He was Prime Minister in 1964 when he took over from Macmillan just for a little while before Harold Wilson was elected. But he'd already been Foreign Secretary, and he's brought him back as Foreign Secretary, and it was Alec Douglas Hume that authorised the foreign and Commonwealth officials to carry out this public disinformation act. The other people involved in it were Geoffrey Rippon, who was his hatchet man, or henchman, whatever you want to call it. I mean, he travelled over to Europe and procured all sorts of stuff and came back to Heath. And the final member of the group was William Whitelaw, strangely enough. He became Deputy Prime Minister under Margaret Thatcher. Now, I think his role in all this was more of somebody who kind of knew what was going on. I don't actually get him as being directly as involved as Heath, Alec Douglas, Hume and Rippon, but nonetheless he was in on it. That should say he obviously kept quiet about it, and of course he moved his way up the greasy pole and he became Deputy Prime Minister to Thatcher in the 1980s. Interestingly enough, he didn't resign until 1988. And at that same time, of course, was when Thatcher made her Bruges speech, which was denouncing the whole EU, which so angered Jacques Delors, the commissioner of the EU, who sort of strove then by hook or by crook to get rid of her, which of course he did through Geoffrey Howe and Heseltine. It took a couple of years, but he achieved that. So maybe Whitelaw has more of an influence in government than we thought. I don't know, but that's certainly one thing to be aware of. Heath, of course, signed us in to the first of the treaties which bound us into Europe. That was called the European Communities Act. And there was another accession treaty which followed that in 1973 called the Accession Act. And that is relevant because both Heath and Rippon were paid considerable amounts of money by the EU to sign us into the EU. Recently, I got hold of some information through a financial journal, which said that in fact this practice of paying government officials for their signatures on the EU to sort of drive the whole EU process forward, that had actually been, it wasn't just Heath and Rippon, it didn't stop there. It carried on straight, it's still carrying on to this day, and there are vast sums of money involved. There is a Swiss slush fund in Switzerland, which the EU can access, and it's up to $5 billion. £1,000, and that's what's actually been paid out since 1972. This was as of 2005, so this information's about some 10 years old, but it's only just come to light. What they did was to pay, they allocated sums of money to pay to whole countries within the member states, and the prime ministers of member states, $100 million on their signatures to the treaties, and then another $100 million for each one on ratification of the treaty. So $5 billion, which was paid out to all the then 25 member states, of all of their politicians who then opened up offshore accounts. And this is in a financial journal. I've got the name of it somewhere here, if I can remember it. Anyway, anybody who wants to know can come and see me afterwards. And so, can we go to the next one? Fine. Walter Hallstein. Now, this guy, I wondered who he was, and I didn't know who he was until I was made aware of researches of a German doctor. This guy is an enormously significant person within the EU. He's a hugely influential character. He's an ex-Nazi, and he managed to hide his past as a lawyer by redacting a lot of documents at Nuremberg, so he escaped all that. He was a European commissioner from 1958 to 68, 10 years. That, of course, was the crucial time when this whole sort of process was moving on. One of the things he did, I'm going to quote from his 1939 speech, which he made at Nuremberg, because, as I say, he was a high-ranking lawyer in the sort of geopolitical front. And he wrote a speech about the legal entity of Greater Germany. And what he said in this speech was that it subjugates the people and the territories to the sovereignty of the mother state with its defined legislative and executive constitutional powers. Now, if we fast forward, this was in 1939, if we fast forward 70 years to the Lisbon Treaty, their Enabling Act uses exactly the same terminology. It refers to the people and territories of the European countries as being subjugated to the sovereignty of the mother state, i.e. the Brussels, together with the legislative and executive constitution of powers. So this is an enormously significant guy. What he did was he had this plan. He was one of the people who planned this geopolitical Greater Germany solution as part of the Nazi thing in the 30s, as I've said. But he used bits of that to that plan, or used the plan, and he brought it in to the European Union itself. When he became commissioner in 1958, he introduced that. And of course he was a huge influence on Edward Heath. He paid several visits to Chequers to Edward Heath, and he promised that he'd be by Heath's side in the early 1970s when this accession treaty and European Communities Act treaty went through, which got us illegally into the European Union. I say illegally because people say, oh, we don't have a constitution in this country. Well, we do, but it's not contained in one document. It's contained in several documents. The wording of one of these, a couple of these documents, I think it's the Act of Settlement or Bill of Rights 1689, I think it is, and Mr. Hagen's Corpus Act 1679. But the wording in a couple of these documents says basically, in modern translation, that no foreign power shall be able to ascertain any authority in this land unless the people are contacted or given consent to do so. So in fact, what Edward Heath did by putting this into the EU in the first place was illegal because he was giving power away to a foreign entity, somebody abroad, and we should have been consulted about it. Now, again, this whole question of a referendum comes up, and some people say, well, we already had a referendum in 1975. That referendum didn't ask us if we wanted to be in the European Union, it asked us if we wanted to stay in the European Union. That was the wording. Harold Wilson, Prime Minister at that time, had a constitutional dilemma because he knew, probably, he was a wily old sod, and he knew that there'd been problems and that we'd probably gone into EU illegally. So that's why that referendum question was asked in the way it was. But in itself, that throws up yet another problem, another constitutional problem, because how could we actually be asked to stay in something that we shouldn't have been allowed to go in the first place? So the referendum was illegal, and he's taking us into Europe was illegal. We've got a double whammy of illegal stuff going on here. So, and this just shows how we've all been deceived. Not only did Heath deceive us on that, he also deceived us on another, on the huge point of sovereignty, by saying that the European Economic Community, as it was then, was purely a trade agreement, and going into it is never going to affect our sovereignty. When he knew all along, and he'd known for the previous 10 years, since he first met Walter Hallstein in 1960, when he was European Commissioner, and he was told bluntly then that if we go down this path, it'll be to a federal Europe. There won't be anything else. It'll be a federal Europe, and no country will have its sovereignty as an individual thing. So he is, as I say, a hugely influential person, an ex-Nazi who covered his tracks very carefully and bought a lot of that jargon, a lot of the Nazi policies by stealth, through stealthy means of stealth, into the European Union. Right, this guy, Count Richard Nicholas von Kuhnhof-Kolerby, what a mouthful that is. Now, this is the guy who created the pan-European movement, and he was mentor to Otto von Habsburg, another one of these bloodline people, who's into tracing his bloodline back to ancient Egypt or wherever. This chap is probably the godfather, nearest thing to the godfather of the European movement. His vision was of a one world government, and this was back in the 1920s, remember, ruled by a spiritual elite and comprising Freemasons and such similar secret society initiates, along with the royal representatives and European nobility. So another person who was into creating a global elite that would be unaccountable to virtually anybody, I would think. Baron Louis de Rothschild, he was so impressed with this chap, with the Count, that he telephoned him and said, can we meet up, let's have a meeting, I'll introduce you to some people that will be beneficial to you. And so he did, and the people that introduced Count Nicholas to were the Warburg brothers, Paul Warburg, Max Warburg, and somebody called Bernard Baruch, who was, again, very influential. He was a big influence on Clinton, along with Zbigniew Brzezinski. Now, just talking about the Warburg brothers for the moment, the elder brother, Paul Warburg, was one of the prime movers in the creation of the US Federal Reserve, just prior to the First World War. Max Warburg, his brother, was Hitler's banker. He was also a director of the IG Farben cartel, which funded the Second World War. The IG Farben cartel is made up of several different companies, as far as I recall. One of them is Bayer. That company still exists today, and it's one of the prime backers of the European Union. So you have a cycle here, a continued cycle, which started again in the Nazi era and is still continuing today, with much the same sort of people involved. One of the things Count also did was that he created a sort of regionalised map of the world, where the world was all sort of chopped up into sections. And actually, if you look at this thing, it's rather like what George Orwell predicted with Oceania and whatever they were, the sort of four or five regions of the world. And in fact, you may think, well, look, this is a long time ago, and what's it got to do with the European Union today? Well, the European Union has its most prestigious award, which is awarded to people that have furthered its aims and so on. And this award is called the Count Richard Kuhnhof-Kolerby Award, and it's just been presented to Herman von Rompuy, the former Council of Europe president. So he's actually a hugely important person. And now, this is a regionalisation map. This is not exactly, well, not, but this is just one of Britain. This is not what necessarily what the Count had in mind, but it's on similar lines. And what's important here is that we've heard a lot lately about devolving power into various regions, Britain, devolving power into local councils, so on and so forth. Well, this is the EU's own regionalisation map, and as you can see, it doesn't look as if it doesn't fare very well for us if we're in that bottom part. It looks like we're going to have a capital city of, well, it is, of Calais, as that's actually named in the document there. And this is the sort of division of Britain under this, in this situation. What's going on at the moment is, I'm fairly convinced that this devolvement of power into local councils, like, it sounds great, it sounds, oh, we're having our democracy back, oh, this is marvellous, and power being devolved to local councils. But something in a couple of years' time called qualified majority voting is going to come, somebody knows about it, is going to come into force. And what this does, I've got some details of it here, so please take them. But just to summarise it, is that this removes our right to veto. It has been introduced in three stages, and the final stage is on the 1st of April 2017. And this is called the double majority rule, whereby you have to get permission of four other countries, totally 35% of the population of the EU, before you can do anything. And it affects 44 policy areas. One of the policy areas it affects is our right to withdraw from the European Union. So that's going to go in a couple of years' time unless we do something about it. The other area it affects is the local government devolution and the committees. So in fact, we can set up what we think are devolved committees. But in fact, what's going to happen when qualified majority voting is that those committees, those regional assemblies, as they're called, because we they call that now under this sort of proposed local government shake-up. And of course, the EU calls them also regional assemblies, the same word. But what it really means is that if that happens, Westminster Parliament will be bypassed, but this is going to create a constitutional problem. Whoever does it, whether we do it, or whether first, before the EU does it, it's going to create a constitutional problem, because Westminster Parliament is going to be come even more defunct powers when this goes through. But this is all in line with EU policy. After the 1st of April 2017, it's going to be, the EU Committee is going to be issued their directives, their laws, regulations, whatever, and they're going to come straight into the councils bypassing the European Parliament, possibly. That is certainly one outcome of it. Right. That's the sort of modern version of what's going on, the EU consolidating its power. The next one. Right, this going back, a while to what I was talking about earlier. I said that. I said that the European Parliament, this one, is very important in the symbology of Nimrod. There you have the two versions. You have the Tower of Babel. That comes from a 15th or 16th century painting by a Dutch painter. And this one is the European Parliament itself. And you can see that this is an unfinished building along with that. And that's absolutely deliberate, because this says that the European Parliament is a work in progress. And the fact that it's allied to Nimrod is interesting, because Nimrod is one of the founder figures. He's very important in the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, which is practiced in the USA. They see him in Cole Smith's encyclopedia. There's a reference to him, to Nimrod, as being one of the founders of Masonic work, not actually a Freemason, because obviously that didn't come till later, but the idea of using labour to build a tower like that which would allegedly get nearer to God. Now, you have to be a bit careful there, because that's the biblical version. there are other versions, and I personally believe that rather than build it to try and get to nearer to God, this was something that they did to honour the workers, to honour Nimrod himself, and always provide him with a sort of passage to sort of so-called heaven as a deity. So rather than it be the sort of a Christian aspect of it merely being a monument to God, it's a monument to Nimrod as God, both the deity and mortal. I think that's probably one of the things that's behind it. A journalist asked a European official when this thing was completed in 1999, why the Tower of Babel? What's this all about? And this guy said, the European official said, well, what Nimrod started in whatever it was 3,000 years ago, we intend to finish. Uh-huh. Now, I wonder exactly what it meant about that. We intend to finish. The next slide, please. But this is a poster from 1957. This is a European poster from 1957. Now, here, what we seem to have here is the combination of exactly of the two things that we've just seen. In other words, the Tower of Babel, European Parliament building at Strasbourg, is combined in one image there. There's even a crane there, indicating that it's a work in progress. Europe, many tongues, one voice. Now, the Tower of Babel legend is all about once they start building this tower, they get closer to God, and then they have a communication problem, they get confused, and they can't speak to each other anymore, and they all sort of scatter to the floor. Wayne will probably know more about this, but I will. They sort of scatter to the four corners of the earth. But once again, as I say, this is all to do with Nimrod and his own deification in the Masonic Encyclopedia as well. These stars above it, they are very significant, because when this first came out in 1957, there were a lot of complaints from Christians, and they had to remove it because they said, well, it's an inverted pentagram, it's satanic. Well, yes, that is so. That is one explanation of it, but there's a little bit more to it than just a satanic inverted pentagram. That, although it's not necessarily a positive thing, it just represents an alternative version of paganism or worship or whatever. That is the insignia, the inverted pentagram, of somebody called Chem Zoroaster, or Ham. Now, there are two versions of exactly who this character is. One is that he's the son of Noah, that's the biblical version. But the Dragon Court version is somewhat different. That says that he's actually from the Tubal Cain line. He's the son or the grandson of Tubal Cain, which brings him onto the bloodline of Cain, as opposed to the bloodline of Canaan. Cain and Canaan are two different people, though they go back to virtually the same source as this so-called fallen angel's bloodline. But one thing they both agree on is that Chem Zoroaster is the grandfather of Nimrod. So you can see the connection there. Nimrod, as the builder of the Tower of Babel, those stars, or inverted pentagrams, whatever you want to call them, satanic if you like, they are his sign. And so again, this symbology, this very ancient symbology, is important to the EU, which of course considers itself to be virtually a religion in itself. But which religion? I wonder if this is what they're really into. Right, can we go next one? Ah, yes, Chris Booker. Now, this guy's ex-editor of Private Eye, and he's a columnist in the Telegraph, Sunday Telegraph. This kind of sums up, really, the modern EU castle of lies. It's actually a title from a Franz Kafka novel about a strange village that has various people in it who sort of is teeming with officials, and it's a sort of castle on a hill, castle on the hill. The village has actually got people in it who are completely dumbed down by these people in the castle on the hill. It just seems to sum up to me what the EU is about, basically. I mean, again, it's people who are never in the wrong. They think themselves to be above everything. And of course, it has a democratic facade. One of the things we need to be aware of, but the biggest threat, I believe, to our democracy at the moment is something called TTIP. Quite a few people will be aware of TTIP, and this stands for the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership. Now, this thing's been around for a while, and it came to a head at the end of last year, where there was a secret meeting convened in Berlin. But the partnership, by the way, is between the US corporates and the European Commission. And what it does is to pave the way, lays the way open for the corporations, the US corporations, to be able to take over the public services of any member state in Europe. What's more, if the country concerned tries to block it, tries to balk it in any way, they can be sued by the corporation concerned. And so the whole thing is weighted in favour of the corporations. It's completely anti-democratic. And news of it only leaked out at the last minute. There were big demonstrations about it at the end of last year in November. These were reported on RT, Russia Today, but not in the BBC or anywhere. I don't remember seeing it in any newspapers, even The Guardian. And one of the people who was actually allowed into this meeting was one of the Euro MPs, a lady. And when she went in, apparently when she first went into the sort of lobby of the meeting, the officials came out. She had to sign the European Espionage Act straight away, that she wouldn't reveal what was said under knowledge, under sort of threat of, well, being prosecuted by it. She used her own pen to do it, and once she'd done that, the official took her pen. He searched for recording equipment. Any notepads like this she had were confiscated. She went into the meeting not able to take any notes or relay any information to anybody. When she came out, she said, well, what? All she did say was what transpired in there was absolutely, totally undemocratic. And what this does is to lay open, unfortunately, the sell-off of the health service in this country. I mean, the health service, in my view, and I'm sure most people here, wasn't created in view of allowing foreign corporations to be able to take it over. It is ideally for the people, it's for us to be run, and for the public servants, people who are in it, to be accountable to us. So this is something that we've got to be aware of, because I do consider it to be, you know, probably the biggest threat to democracy as we could possibly have. And yet we actually have more power in this than we might think, because if we actually have a look at sovereignty and what that really means, most people think of sovereignty as something that, well, it's the Queen, or it's the Parliament that's sovereign, or it's the nation that's sovereign. Well, actually, it's us. It's all of us. The power is with us. We are the sovereigns. And that goes back to the Malmutus Code. King Malmutus, one of the ancient kings who created this code of practice, one of the things that he created was the fact that people have the power, or have a certain amount of weight over the crown and over the royalty. In other words, we grant sovereignty to the royalty, to the parliament or whatever, not the other way around. So I think it is still possible for us to we put enough pressure on our leaders and keep at it, and it's like water dripping away a stone. You have to keep at it all the time, and I think if we're bearing that in mind, that we are sovereign rather than anybody else, even the parliament, it's still possible to effect a situation whereby we can get out of this mess, and this castle of lies here in front of us can come crashing to the ground, leaving the people who are involved in its administration to pick up the pieces, whilst the rest of us can get on with our lives, knowing that we really do have the power. I'm Toy Newton. Thank you very much. be a half-hour break before our next, before Andy will go on and deliver his talk. So I will take, I can probably do 10 minutes question and answers.
Time's running out, sorry.
Sorry?
Sorry, I didn't say something else. I was going to say, time, in terms of what your conclusion was.
Yes.
And I hope the optimistic conclusion you were.
Yes, well, I think we've got to
time
be
is running out, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we've got to be optimistic.
But time is running out.
Yeah, it is running out. With this qualified majority voting coming in a couple, of, couple of years' time. You know, it, we're in the late show. No, we're on the, in the last station on the line on this. And so we've got to move it along soon. And all right, it's great to see everybody here who's sort of aware of everything. And, you know, people out there are still sort of being sidetracked by what they see in the mainstream media and all sorts of other things and that, which are acting as such. Yes?
Sorry,
sir. Yes?
You know that map in 1972?
Yes.
The one country that wasn't named was England. There was Scotland, Wales...
Are you talking about Coudenhove Kalerby's map? Yes, yeah, that's right.
England was not...
No, we were, it, that's perfectly correct. It wasn't in that, in his account of the sort of global, whatever, his global vision. Yes, that's absolutely true.
So England is abolished? That's what they want. They want to abolish England.
Sure, I mean, you've got that regionalisation map you can see there. I think Scotland and Wales, well, Scotland doesn't look too happy, but England certainly will be part of this North Sea region or whatever. Again, the regionalisation, of course, this ties in with what's happening with the local councils. People don't realise it. People think, oh, we're going to have democracy back. Great, you know, but unfortunately not. I can see that. And once the qualified majority voting comes in, it will cover committees, it will cover councils. And that's kind of what we're heading full at. We're plunging headlong towards it. Yes?
Is it possible to get a copy of this map? Is it, like, available on your website?
Or anything? I wish it was.
You could Google it, can't
you? Yeah.
You just Google reshape to view of Europe map, isn't it? Like
yes, yeah, I think you can. Yeah, you can get a printout of it.
Can you clarify that line is dividing the Thames? The Thames dividing the Thames, allegedly.
It looks a bit. I think so. I mean, we are paired with Dordogne, France in this
southeast.
So the capital is Calais.
Talking about this same sort of thing.
Yes, Tony.
How do you think we can stop it?
Yes, it's getting, as I say, we're in the last station of the line. It's getting really easy in the late show, but now. Yes, I think we can, but we've got to put enormous... I mean, the only way to do it is to put enormous amounts of pressure. Also, to get, for the other European people, we're going to need to partner them in some way or another to put pressure on the other European leaders, so we can do it ourselves with our own parliament. But Spain will be a very good place to start, because there's a Spanish Podemos there. This is the anti-austerity party, the equivalent to what's going on in Greece, but it's got more clout, because Spain is considered to be a more important country. In terms of the EU, and they're really getting active over there. So that could be something that we may have to sort of form an alliance of sort of rebels and English rebels and Spanish rebels. You know.
Are the Podemos party aware of all this?
Oh yes, I'm pretty sure they are. I mean, they were in Germany for the demo against the new European Central Bank, where they sort of set fire to the cars surrounding it. The police came in and put barbed wire around it. There are 10,000 demonstrators. This is a recent thing. But there are also 10,000 policemen. Police with that every demonstrator. So, I mean, they were determined to crush it. But I mean, it is going to be a sort of superhuman effort that's required. There's no doubt. It's so difficult. We've just got to sort of keep at it. And mainstream media are not helping, I have to say that, and until we can get some sort of alternative going, if only, we've more or less got to do it ourselves. But they just want to continually keep us being dumbed down. And what they're not telling us now is, well, it's nothing short of an effrontery, in my view, you know, what we're not being told. Yes?
How do we stand, do you think, with sort of bringing this kind of material into a court?
This is very interesting. A guy called Roger Hayes, who Wayne knows, is to do with the constitutional group. I'm not sure what position he is, but he's, this is the guy who's tried to arrest and has arrested the judge. I think it was in the Midlands. So he's very active in this sort of area, and that's kind of one way to do it. Yes, the courts, whilst before corpus jure and the EU law comes in, and we still have habeas corpus and common law. Yes, it's got to be done within the next couple of years or so.
Albert Burgess, who's talking here in 2 weeks' time, he's got this idea of reporting treason to your local police.
Yes, sedition.
With
sedition.
Documentation that he's prepared. So that's another.
How has he been personally about this?
That's been done for a long time.
Yeah, this is the culmination of years. It's
and
not.
McWhirton, he reported that.
Yes,
in Hexham. And he was thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
Treason at Maastricht.
They knew they weren't going to allow English people, as the English, English people to have any say at all.
Toyd, what's your view on UKIP? Do they have the solutions to this?
Whilst I agree with a lot of the things they're saying, they worry me because there's a lack of environmental policy within UKIP, and they've got to really shape up. They have the clout to be able to. I think perhaps the best we can hope for is perhaps a coalition with one of the other parties, but they have the clout to be able to do so. The problem with UKIP is that it's composed of two different factions of people. You've got the sort of ex-Thatcherites, the Neil Hamiltons and those sort of people in the party, but you've also got the thinking people, the real constitutionalists, as I call them. Those are the people that we need to come into the forefront in UKIP, because it was actually started by, I think, either Cambridge or an Oxford Don many years ago as a constitution, because we could see what was going to happen, because we could see the road, the path ahead was going to be very difficult, and we needed something to safeguard all our rights and everything. But he left after the sort of Thatcherites and the ex-Tories kind of moved in and took over. So there is that problem in there. And if only that could be addressed, and if there could be a way to get the two sides together, then they need to really get together to shape up their policies. It would be possible. That would certainly be an outcome. But it's going to take... It's good to say quite a lot of work and burying of egos within the party as well, actually. That's got to, and I don't know whether how possible that is, but it can be done. But again, hard work, you know. But I think they do have, certainly on Europe, they do have the policy. They know about this stuff. The qualified majority voting that I've got there, that's Gerald Batten. He's a very good London UKIP candidate. He's very good. So he's one of the people that could have an effect on this. But it all depends what the outcome of this election is, you know. We've just got to wait and see.
Well, have you got a preferred outcome in terms of these issues, in terms of the election? In terms of the election and how it goes, do you have a preferred outcome in terms of challenging this?
Obviously, the more votes that the anti-EU parties get, there was going to be a left... I don't know whether Tusk... anti-EU, because there was going to be another left anti-EU party called Say No to the EU. And this was going to be, which had been started by Bob Pro, the RTM rail union guy. But unfortunately, as soon as he announced he was going to start this, he was going to be the driving force behind it. Within a week or so, he was dead. At the age of 54 or whatever. I don't know if to ask. Yes, sorry, you're...
Sorry, but so why are you pro-TTIP if there's an EU?
Yes, this is a very good point. That is a very good point.
It can't be shut out to America, but it won't shut out to Europe.
Yeah, that is a very good point, actually. And that's one of the reasons why I have so much reservations about them. They are a worry.
I've got to say, my friend is standing for UKIP. He couldn't be here tonight. He's actually had another meeting about TTIP in Brighton, which is a...
Oh, really? Oh, so they are debating
clashing tonight. Yeah, and he had to stand up in as a UKIP candidate. He's against TTIP.
Good.
And Nigel Farage and UKIP have said they're against TTIP.
Oh, really? So they turned
Tim Cross in Worthing on Monday, said he's pro-TTIP.
Well, he's obviously wrong, because if you Google UKIP's policy...
A lot of them are pro-TTIP.
I can't see you wrong, you're probably not, but I can only talk from my own experience. I know that our local candidates are against it, and there is something online, a press conference with UKIP, where they say, I think it's on YouTube, Well, they do say that they're against it. So have a look at that, see what you make of it.
So I can good. Nice. That's a positive thought. I'm pleased about that. Right, excellent. Okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
I think we cannot ignore the biblical images because, you know, we need to look at it politically, socially and economically, but ultimately these images, you know, Tower of Babel, the woman riding the beast, they're biblical images.
Mm.
And the Tower of Babel was basically a rebellion against God, and God judged it.
Yes.
So if this is intentional, the founders of the EU, deliberately, they knew what they were doing. Because it was based on Bruegel's painting of the Tower of Babel, which is an unfinished building. And so it's, you're talking, you know, bottom line, it is blatant pride and rebellion against the one true God. And that can only result in judgment.
Yeah. So, well, let's hope so, yeah.
And so,
let's hope so.
But we're already under judgment. And Islam has to come into this picture because, you know, they are making inroads all over the world, and especially in Europe. So ultimately, bottom line, it's rebellion against God. And they know what they are doing.
Yeah.
The symbols are blatantly satanic. The inverted stars are blatantly satanic. You know, the woman riding the beast is not even subtle.
No.
So, you know, this is a spiritual battle. This is a spiritual one.
Absolutely.
Ultimately.
Absolutely.
And that's what the EU played a central role in Muslim revolution on every scale.
Sorry?
So has not the EU played a central role in the phenomenal level of Islamic immigration into Europe? Would you say?
Yes, I would, absolutely. If because the Tower of Babel, because the founders of the EU, they knew what they were doing. They deliberately founded the EU based on the on Bruegel's painting, which was the Tower of Babel. So they knew what they were doing, and you know, the Tower of Babel was actually to try to escape the judgment of God because of the flood. And they believed they could build a tower high enough to escape another flood. And God judged it, and it was one, and you know, obviously the languages were dispersed. So it's blatant, intentional, conscious rebellion against God. That's what we're talking about. So it's a principality. It's a, you know, I may sound wacky to you, but it's a demonic principality of overt and blatant rebellion against the Most High God.
Against the Christian God, are you saying? Christian.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, against the one true, like, you know.
To make it clear.
Yeah, I know that sounds, you know, dogmatic. Or
no, whatever. Not so money on this, I don't think it does, no.
But because the images are spirit, you know, they're biblical. The woman riding the beast.
Yes, Chris.
Biblical
sorry
images.
To cut. Sorry
that's
to
okay.
cut. Chris.
No, I'll just mention that the five-pointed star is the emblem of Amalek.
Yes.
Which God said he would have war with generation to generation. And that's why we got the Pentagon is in the five shape.
Yeah.
Five points. And also there were 11 stars, which is the number of God.
Yes. Sorry.
Yeah, is there a, I meant to catch up on what I missed when I, at the beginning of the talk, is there anything on YouTube or you have anything yourself that I can access?
I've only got one with John Tapsell on the London, my research into London's mystical legacy on the London book. I haven't got one. This is all sort of fairly new, so I'm not sort of there with this yet.
Can we roll through the slides again?
Sorry?
Can we roll through the slides again from the start, very briefly, just to see what they were?
Yeah, sure.
Good idea. Some of the images. Yeah.
Just go through, I don't have to say, just literally give a name for each one and just say what it was so that we don't have to repeat that whole thing. But
no, well, this is Woman Riding the Beast, and again, you've got the stars there, which are the stars of the goddess, not the European countries. And it's interesting in that one, this comes from Time magazine, you've got the flags of all the countries on the back there.
Union Jack?
No, Union Jack.
Yeah, Union Jack. Yeah. France, various other people. That one's outside the European Parliament building, and that is, of course, the European Parliament building is the one that is being built in the shape of the Tower of Babel. That one is outside the European Commission building in Brussels, and the Commission, of course, is where all the laws are made and their decisions are final. The European Parliament can't do anything about it because it has no power, basically. It's just a talking shop. That's a stamp that was issued in 1979, a British stamp, 20.5p, commemorating, it's the same image, not with the stars, but the woman riding the beast. These two things are further images. Again, you've got the stars there and the woman riding the beast around the other way around, basically. It's the same image. Ted Heath, yes, committed us to Europe illegally on several counts. And Walter Hallstein, such a huge, the German ex-Nazi, such a huge influence on Edward Heath and the European Union itself. Count Kalergi, if I can pronounce his name properly, the spiritual godfather of the EU. He wanted a world government that was consisted of a spiritual elite and Freemasons. And that's the EU regionalisation map we were just talking about. There we have Tower of Babel and the EU Parliament. One is almost like a symbolic image of the other. And there we have the two combined, and there are your stars again, inverted pentagrams. And finally, Chris Booker's book, Castle of Lies, which symbolises the EU exactly as a sort of entity on its own, trying to control everybody.
Okay. There have been allegations against Edward Heath that he was a paedophile.
Yes, that's, that's Bill Maloney's.
Which feeds into
I'm waiting to see where that goes, actually, but I'm pretty sure it's connected to that. Le Grand, the Guernsey Jersey.
I just wondered as well, Toyney, about they talk about Turkey coming into the EU.
Yes, that's been on the cards
for
some time.
A sort of European bridge to the Middle East, but also there's been speculation about a revived Islamic caliphate in Turkey, and now that could lead into this. Should Europe?
Yes,
but
some of them
throw
ISIS,
aren't
they? We've
got an Islamic caliphate coming into Europe.
Quite like
an invitation. Invitation.
What's the concern about the caliphate?
Well, the Islamification of Europe. It'd be like an Islamic pope in Europe.
Sorry?
Okay. Right. Can we sort of cut it there? Because we've got to get Andy on in about 10 minutes.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.